Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. How intimate is your connection to great art? While Raymond and Patsy Nasher made many of the pieces in their world-class sculpture collection available for public view, the works never lost their deeply personal meanings to them. And 5 years after the opening of the sculpture center that bears their name, the personal stories of the Nasher collection are being shared as well. Their daughter, Nancy A. Nasher, is here to talk about her own memories, along with Jed Morse, who is acting chief curator of the Nasher Sculpture Center. Nancy, Jed, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Jed, I have to imagine that many of the people who come to the Sculpture Center are at least as curious about the two individuals who collected all these amazing pieces as they are about the works themselves. Was this like a by popular demand sort of exhibition?
Well, for our fifth anniversary this fall, it seemed a natural thing to put together an exhibition to give the public a better idea of the people behind the collection, the people who spent 40 years of adventures collecting modern art. And there is a natural curiosity with among the public to see, to know a bit more about Raymond and Patsy Nasher.
Nancy, you were just a kid when your parents brought home their first major piece of sculpture. Do you remember when it came into the house?
Well, I vividly remember it because it was in 1967, and my mother surprised my father for his 46th birthday with this beautiful piece of sculpture called Torso with Buds by Jean Arp, the French artist that he made in 1961, and she surprised him for his 46th birthday. So it arrived at the house. She placed it by the front door, and he was thrilled, and she was so excited because it gave her butterflies, and she had hoped that it would give him butterflies as well, and of course it did.
And I guess they worked really well as a team when it came to acquiring pieces.
Well, she really was the curator of the collection. She had a great curiosity about art and artists and landscape and everything. And it was really her work. But she was a great partner with my father and creating North Park. And they were true partners in the business world as well as the artistic world.
And didn't always necessarily agree on what to acquire, I know.
You know, Ray always told a funny story about how they would resolve conflicts. He would say that if I liked something and Patsy didn't, then we would talk about it, we'd discuss it, we'd think about it. And if Patsy liked something and I didn't, then we bought it. So it made those conflicts a little bit easier. And I think he said that partially in jest, because they really enjoyed doing this together. Patsy was out in front, the catalyst for the whole thing. Ray was very busy with his business pursuits, and Patsy took on collecting as her job. And so she did her homework, as everyone always says. Patsy always did her homework. She read all of the exhibition catalogs. She learned as much as she could about the artists that they collected, went to all of the exhibitions and galleries. And then once she found something that was really extraordinary, she would call in Ray and say, hey, you've got to come see this thing. And so ultimately, the decision was theirs together. And they always said, as Nancy mentioned, that the ultimate litmus test was if it gave them butterflies. They had to have that visceral emotional reaction to a work of art.
They had to love, each piece, and because we lived with the art. Each piece of art was either inside our home or outside in the landscape. So they never bought a piece of art that they didn't truly love, and it had to be, very significant and personal to them. And I do believe that there were certain artists that my father preferred over my mother, and she allowed him, to collect that particular artist's work. So it was a true partnership.
What were their moods like on the days when these really large pieces were being installed? Because there's always a hazard, I know, that something will fall or that the people installing things won't get it quite right. Were they giddy? Were they nervous? Were they sort of on edge?
They were both. They were all of the above. Mm-hmm. They were giddy, nervous, excited, thrilled. Exactly. They were very involved with the placement of the art. They were constantly moving the art. around the backyard or in the house because they like to enjoy it and see it from different perspectives over the years. But certain pieces were so large that once they were placed, that was it.
They were going to live there.
They were going to live there, yes.
I know, Jed, that there's only one piece at the museum that is sort of built specifically for the site. Mm-hmm. And so everything else moves around. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. We have approximately 325 works of modern and contemporary sculpture in the collection, but we can only show about a third at any one time. So we rotate the collection through the Sculpture Center on a regular basis, change things around probably once every 3 or 4 months. Some of the very large things in the garden, we change up and like to bring new things in and move things around to just as Raymond and Patsy did. Because as you change those relationships, you create new conversations and new dialogues between the works of art, and so new things emerge. Ray said that a sculpture offers 360 different works of art because it changes as you move around it. And if you look at something once, twice, three, five, 10, 100 times, it's different every time you see it.
Well, there are certain pieces that can't be moved, like the Richard Serra, which are two blades of each weighing 55,000 pounds. Mm-hmm. And also Jonathan Borofsky's great Walking to the Sky, which is cemented, secured in the ground. It weighs 14,000 pounds. And there are certain pieces that are more difficult to move.
Your parents had kids and grandkids. What was it like sort of living with these works of art that most of us can only see in a museum setting?
Well, we were just very fortunate to have parents that pursued many things with great passion and love and joy. And they instilled in us an appreciation for art and music and buildings and architecture. And so it was truly, we were very privileged.
Was there a room that you weren't allowed to cross unless there was an adult around? Were they concerned about things breaking?
Oh, no. I mean, every room was filled with art. Our bedrooms, the hallway, the dining room, the breakfast room was filled with Andy Warhol soup cans. I mean, outside, inside. So we learned from a very young age to be very careful. And they taught us how to appreciate art. But there are certain pieces that, we were allowed to touch, and they did too, and embrace, some of the great bronzes. And, it's just part of it. You have to feel it. Although Jed gets scared every time I say that, but you have to feel it, touch it. I mean, that's part of the experience.
I think that's maybe the privilege of being the owner as opposed to someone who enjoys it in a museum.
That's correct.
That is something that I know that you have to deal with a lot when people come to the museum and sculpture is so tactile.
Sure.
How do you help people sort of get past that desire to put their hands on things?
Well, what we try to do is to teach them, what happens. Part of the mission of any museum is to, of course, to preserve these incredible objects for future generations. And, there are, even if you've just washed your hands, there are oils and acids in your on your fingertips, naturally occurring on your skin, that are actually corrosive even to metal. And so we try to educate the public about that and get them to understand a little bit about why we say please don't touch the works of art, so that they can be enjoyed by their children and their grandchildren and their grandchildren's grandchildren.
Well, there is a piece of art in the garden that's by Scott Burton that is made out of a stone that my mother and Scott Burton went to Maryland and went to the quarry and picked, where you actually sit on the piece, and it's supposed to, you're supposed to touch it and feel it and sit on it and enjoy the beauty of the garden. And the James Turrell, you sit inside of it, mm-hmm. and look up at the sky. So there are a few pieces that you can touch.
You mentioned Andy Warhol earlier, Nancy, and I know that he was one of many artists that your mother in particular grew to have a great friendship with. And I guess he did some portraits, and you directed Andy Warhol at some point.
I did. It's quite a story. But it was a great experience. He was a good friend of my mother's, and he did a beautiful portrait of her. And she asked him to do the portrait of myself and my two older sisters. And he came to Dallas. And she traded, actually, some pieces of prints and jewelry and artwork of her own for to have the portraits done. He came to the Stoneleigh Hotel in Dallas, and we each went at our own, you know, specified times. And he covered us in a white cosmetic powder called Erase, and all of our skin, every bit of our skin and our shoulders, they wrapped us in a towel, and he covered us with this thick paste. And then he brought us in, and he took what seemed to me like a few hundred Polaroids. He put us in a pose, and we looked right at him, and he showed us the Polaroids along the way. And it was quite an experience, and we had a function for him that night, and he was a wonderful man, very shy, soft-spoken, quiet, but with piercing eyes. And when my portrait came, the coloration of my hair was not accurate. I didn't feel in comparison to my sisters. And so I told my mother, and she called Andy Warhol and said, my daughter isn't pleased with her portrait, and because it's her hair is black as opposed to brown. So we sent it back, and he redid it completely. And it came back several months later. And while I preferred the background of the first piece, I wasn't going to send it back again. But it was truly a memorable and wonderful experience.
I know that you've lost both your parents now, and I have to imagine when you walk through the Sculpture Center in particular, does it feel a little bit like looking through a family album?
It's like being at our home, and it's really seeing the culmination of their lives together. And they started collecting art in 1954, and the very first painting they ever collected of tennis players by Ben Shahn is on exhibit there. And it goes all the way through to 2004, 2005, to Jonathan Borofsky's Walking to the Sky, as we talked about. But it's like being at our home, and I know that it gave them great joy and pleasure to share their art with others as they displayed it at North Park and in their various other commercial establishments. And I know that they were very committed to Dallas and the city, and they worked their whole lives here, and they were deeply committed to sharing it with art with people. And the exhibition that Jed has put together is truly quite moving for me personally, because many of the stories are, they're coming back, through Jed's history, and there will be many more stories to come, because with every piece they collected, there was a story.
And I know that from the beginning they were really passionate about making sure that some of this got shared. And initially, they didn't care whether or not people liked it. They just wanted people in Dallas to be exposed to modern sculpture.
Well, that was really one of the extraordinary things about their stories, of course, their dedication to sharing these incredible works of art with the public, and in a very non-traditional venue. When Ray and Patsy built North Park Shopping Center in 1965, they saw an opportunity, and with these long concourses and these broad plazas for large-scale sculpture. And so, they wanted, and it's one of the wonderful things about this exhibition and doing the research for the exhibition, and visitors get a sense of this through reproductions of family photographs of Ray and Patsy with particular artists who they were friends with, and photographs of the interior of the house, so you get a sense of what it was like to live with these incredible things. But also there are lots of archival interviews with Ray and with Patsy, which we have incorporated into a new video that premieres tonight, and also in the audio tour for the exhibition, and so you get to hear these stories in Ray and Patsy's voices. But one of the things that Patsy says in her interview is that, both she and Ray had these incredible experiences with their encounters with art, and they wanted to provide those opportunities for other people. And so showing works of art at North Park was, they thought, a natural thing for them. And they often, you know, Ray often would say to me, you know, in the beginning, it just didn't matter if people liked it. It was more important that they were exposed to it. Whether the reaction was positive or negative, the exposure was the most important thing.
Very quickly, Nancy, did they ever have buyer's remorse?
Not really, but there were many pieces that they turned down. Many mm-hmm. pieces came to the house that they rejected. So every piece was very, very selective and very personal.
Had to have those butterflies.
Exactly.
Thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us today.
In Pursuit of the Masters, stories from the Raymond and Patsy Nasher collection continue through January 4th. Just ahead on Think, the legendary festival that gave Dallas's best funk musicians a moment in the sun. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Art and Seek calendar for this weekend features a send-up, a stubborn little girl, and a studio stroll. Don your favorite walking shoes and make your way to East Dallas for the 2008 White Rock Lake Artist Studio Tour, a two-day visual feast of works from 45 local artists and a variety of media. For the latest large and small-scale sculpture and drawings from Texas artist Stephen Daly, head to the William Campbell Contemporary in Fort Worth for his new show opening on Saturday. Wrapping up at the Promenade Theater in Richardson, it's the ultimate send-up of the musical comedy and Repertory Company Theater's first-ever green production and the upbeat Tony Award-winning favorite Urinetown. And for more family-friendly offerings, the Dallas Children's Theater presents the tale of a headstrong mouse girl and what happens when the teacher confiscates her magical musical bag in the show Lily's Purple Plastic Purse. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org, a new website for the arts in North Texas. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
Who decides what Dallas music sounds like? In 1970, when many area clubs welcomed only white performers, some of South Dallas's most talented black artists set out to create their own festival and left a lasting impression on the city's music culture.
Young people of today who can look back, or who take the time and have the interest to look back, can see that, for an example, the success that Erykah Badu has had didn't just come about. Somebody had to pave the way, and I think we paved the way for people of her generation, just as people like Buster Smith, who played jazz and Deep Ellum in the 1930s, paved the way for us, who came along 30, 40 years later. You're always standing on someone else's shoulders.
That was musician and Booker T. Washington magnet bandleader Roger Boykin in the KERA documentary South Dallas Pop. The show debuts Wednesday night at 8, and Boykin is here now to talk about the festival that inspired both the film and nearly four decades of great music. Roger, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So where would you go back in the 60s to hear and to play the best music?
Well, in our case, there were several places in the South Dallas area, and I'm speaking of that part of South Dallas near Fair Park. And there were events held at places like, for an example, on Monday nights, we could go to the Longhorn Ballroom, maybe to hear James Brown or somebody, the acts coming through town. And there were a couple of other places like that. In the area that's now known as State Thomas, there were a couple of places, the Zanzibar and the Empire Room, places like that where we could go. But there were quite a few small jazz clubs in the South Dallas area. And then there was the famous jazz concert every Sunday at the American Woodman's Auditorium. And that was about 3 or 4 o'clock on a Sunday evening. And that lasted from about 1957 until 1972. Just about every Sunday.
But there were a lot of clubs where, no matter how good you were, and no matter what kind of a draw you could get in South Dallas or in State Thomas, you weren't welcome in.
Well, that's true. You know, the further north you went in Dallas, of course, you were just generally not able to get gigs. So most of us had careers in the South Dallas area, basically, and then we would go out of town sometimes. We'd go and play at Walker's Auditorium in Waco, and, you know, different places like that. A few places in Fort Worth. There's a place in Arlington called the Black Cat, you know, different places around the area.
And the idea for the festival, did it start small and just get bigger and bigger all the time?
Well, we started with big ideas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had heard about Woodstock. I mean, you know, there was sort of a tradition of having these music festivals. And we called it a pop festival because it had been called a pop festival somewhere else, but it was really a funk festival because the kind of music we played was R&B primarily. There was a small jazz element. For an example, the band that I played in at this pop festival was the Marshall Avery Quintet, and that was primarily a jazz group.
And do you ever regret the name? Do you wish you could go back in time?
I do. Mm-hmm. I do. On the recording, the word pop is crossed out and funk is inserted.
So. You have a new group of fans now and people who have become really interested again in this South Dallas funk music that was produced during that time and kind of an unlikely group of fans.
Yes. Young, primarily white record collectors from really all over the world. Have taken to this music. One of those collectors, a guy whose showbiz name is Egon, whose real name is Ethan Allapat, told me that he thought the best funk from that period came from Texas and North Carolina. And so the things we did, the things we recorded back in the late 60s and early 70s are highly sought after by record collectors in Europe, Japan, and all over America. And it's amazing to me that has happened. And these guys are in their 20s.
You're still playing professionally, and a big part of what you do now is education. Can you talk about your passion for teaching students?
Well, it has to be passed on. And I made a decision quite a few years ago now that when you reach a certain age, or at least for me, when I reached a certain age, I had to start trying to prepare the next generation. Otherwise, the music would die. It's something that jazz is a very new kind of music. It started primarily in the 1920s, I would say. It's kind of an outgrowth of ragtime and so forth. And if we don't pass it on to the next generation, something else is going to come along and take its place. Or it's going to be something that is no longer popular in America. It's gaining in popularity and has been gaining for many years in Europe and Japan, to the extent that most American musicians now who pursue jazz and blues have to travel to Europe and Japan and other parts of Asia, even China, to get the good gigs. The better paying gigs.
Then let's hope we can keep it here for a while. Roger, thanks so much for coming
in. Yes, indeed.
The documentary South Dallas Pop debuts on KERA this coming Wednesday, October 22nd at 8. Free video and audio podcasts of this show are available on the Think page of KERA.org. Send email to think@KERA.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us and have a great week.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. By the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive. And by the valued support of KERA members. Thank you.